A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm Madeline Brand. Let's press play. Sounds of police clearing protesters yesterday from the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Members of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and their supporters have been camped near the pipeline site for months in protest. Yesterday, those protests turned violent. Local police and National Guard soldiers showed up in riot gear. They used pepper spray and piped in high-pitched noise to clear out the demonstrators. More than 140 people were arrested. Sandy Tolan is a journalist who's been covering the Dakota Access Pipeline protests for the Los Angeles Times. He recorded what you just heard. He's also a journalism professor at USC, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you. Well, paint the picture of what happened yesterday.
Well, it was quite a scene. The pipeline access, the Dakota Access Pipeline, is a nearly $4 billion pipeline that's slated to go all the way from northwestern North Dakota all the way to southern Illinois. But standing in the way and camping in the way on their ancient treaty lands, awarded them in 1851 by treaty, were many of the Dakota people and their supporters. But it's also land that was recently purchased by the company, the Fortune 500 company, Energy Transfer Partners, which is building the pipeline. And they were pressuring the state government and others to get this pushed through. And so yesterday, a force of at least 200 police from the National Guard, state police agencies, sheriffs, deputies from five different states, including as far away as Wisconsin and Wyoming, arrived in a line, and eventually another line came, first from the north, then from the west. They were armed with riot gear. They had large mine-resistant vehicle built to withstand IED explosions in Iraq, and they began moving forward. The protesters were, by all accounts, unarmed. There was later a report that, which is disputed, that one woman in the protest group fired a handgun, but that has not been confirmed. But for the most part, the protesters, other than starting a fire with some tires near the beginning of the protest, which was put out by a fire engine brought by the police, they kept backing up as the line of soldier-like police officers moved forward. Then they began making arrests. It emerged today in a piece that I just filed for the LA Times that the people who were arrested had numbers written on the insides of their arms or on their forearms, and they were kept overnight in essentially dog kennels, large enclosures inside the garage at the police station, on concrete without any bedding, any furniture. And one activist who's the incoming chair of the Democratic Party of Nebraska told me that she's seen many of these pipeline fights. She's been in the front lines of them. Never has she seen any activists in Iowa or Nebraska treated like this, like the Native American are being treated here in North Dakota.
And so, as we've said, these protests have been going on for quite some time, many months. Yeah. I believe they started as a small protest back in April. Why now? Why now did they turn violent?
Well, there has been violence before. I mean, there was a dog attacked on September 3rd by a private security company. that actually brought a lot of people out here, because it was filmed by Amy Goodman's team at Democracy Now, and it really inspired a lot of people to come out here because it had such sort of resonance with the early days of the civil rights movement. So it's not the first time. I mean, as I said, for the most part, the protester side has been nonviolent, and there have been rumors that there were pipe bombs, that the rumors apparently started by the police, and which they later acknowledged were false. I think now what's ratcheting up, though, Madeline, is the fact that the energy company that's building this pipeline is very keen to get it online. They want to go under the Missouri River, and in the way are these people who were reclaiming treaty lands, Native Americans and their supporters. It should be noted, however, that the Obama administration and the Standing Rock chairman has called for essentially a civil rights investigation of what's been happening in the last few days especially. But the Obama administration has not given final approval for the company to build its pipeline under the Missouri River. The people on the Standing Rock Reservation are worried about their water supply. They note that Bismarck didn't want the pipeline near them, and so it was diverted to the near the reservation lands, which they call an incident of environmental racism. But the Obama administration still has not given final approval, and so the activists here are vowing to fight on.
And meanwhile, they are fighting in court, right?
Yes. I mean, there is a whole question of whether these treaty lands, there are a number of questions. They're trying to get on different grounds, get the government to withhold its approval to demand a full environmental impact statement. They feel that this was really fast-tracked and rushed through. But also there's a question of the treaty lands and whether the people who are camping there have a right to be there. They say, this is our land. But one of the things that happened yesterday is soldiers, or the soldier-like forces with automatic rifles, began going into tents and opening the tent flaps. This reactivated a kind of historical trauma and reminded many people of the days of the cavalry.
Interesting. Well, they are protesting, as you say, the fear that their drinking water will be contaminated if this pipeline is built, and that sacred sites could be disturbed with the construction of this pipeline. Is there anything else that they're protesting? Are they protesting sort of the larger issue of who owns the land?
Well, there is that, and we discussed that a bit. But I mean, it's interesting that the different people here are bringing different perspectives to it. You know, of course, the company said, look, we went through the whole process. There's nothing illegal here. We have the right to do this. We need to get this oil online. They want to build a 570,000 barrel capacity pipeline, which is, by the way, larger than the entire output of Ecuador, which is an OPEC member. It's a huge pipeline. Mm. But the people who are opposing it oppose it on numerous grounds, including the ones you mentioned, Madeline, the sacred sites, some of which have been destroyed, the safety of the water, not only for the people here, but, you know, 17 million people are relying on Missouri River water. But also there's a number of people with the Indigenous Environmental Network and others connected to the climate change movement who say, we've got to keep it in the ground. And a number of those people are very active in this struggle as well.
Well, Sandy, thanks so much for the update.
Good to talk to you, Madeline.
That's Sandy Tolan. He's a journalist. He's covering the Dakota Access Pipeline protests for the Los Angeles Times. Meanwhile, in Oregon, a protest on public land has ended a lot differently.
Ammon Bundy is
not guilty!
Ryan Bundy is
not guilty!
What about David Frye?
Not guilty!
Okay, yesterday a jury acquitted seven people accused of leading an armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. Among the leaders were Ammon and Ryan Bundy, the sons of cattle rancher Cliven Bundy. The Bundy family has become the face of a national movement that wants the federal government to relinquish control over its western lands. Reporter John Sepulvedo followed the standoff and the trial. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's go back. You were at the refuge during the occupation. It began in January, lasted 41 days. Remind us what the Bundys and the others involved, what they wanted, what they did, and how that occupation ended.
Sure. They wanted the complete transfer of federal lands from the federal government to the state governments in the West. It was a very lofty goal that it was very clear was not going to happen. And to do this, they took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. And they also did it in part to support a ranching family known as the Hammonds that were locals who went to prison for 5 years because of things they did on federal land. So the combination of the two is the reason that they took over this refuge for 41 days.
And how did it end?
It ended pretty, all things considered, it ended pretty peacefully. All but one person was able to leave the refuge alive. The man who died, Lavoie Finicum, is said to have pulled a gun, and video shows it pretty clearly, pulled a gun on police officers, and he was shot during a traffic stop. But besides that, it ended pretty peacefully.
All right, but then they were brought to trial, and what were the essential arguments on both sides?
So the government said that this was a conspiracy case to keep federal employees from essentially doing their duties, and there is no doubt that these men wanted to keep federal employees from doing their duties. But what we're learning very quickly is that the jury was unconvinced that they actually conspired. And they were unconvinced because they said, not because they didn't believe that the men did conspire, or I should say that the occupants did conspire, but because the government didn't prove it. In fact, juror number four just recently spoke to the Oregonian this morning. We don't know who juror number four is. He's still choosing to remain anonymous. But he essentially said the government didn't do a good job of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that these people conspired to keep federal employees from doing their jobs. Now, there was a lot of criticism when these charges were first brought, and that's because there is a whole host of stuff that these guys could have been charged with. They used federal property. They occupied federal land. They did things to archaeological sites. Madeline, one of the most kind of just crazy things that happened, they used federal government's computers to design the website that said the federal government is bad. So there was a lot going on here that they could have been charged with. And the general feeling is that the prosecution didn't do their job. All of that plus the federal government didn't prepare. So I was working for Oregon Public Broadcasting at the time while I was covering this. We were approached, both me and OPB, by the federal government. And this was on a Thursday. The government was scheduled to close their case on a Tuesday. And they said that they wanted me to testify specifically because they believed that their case was being lost and they wanted to get this interview that I conducted with Ryan Bundy in front of the jury. And first of all, this came as a big surprise to us because they had 9 months to come and approach us beforehand and give us the heads up that this was going to happen. And it is a big deal asking a reporter to testify. Of course, I said no, because it's not my job to prove the government's case. But on top of it, they have to, if they wanted to subpoena me, which is something that they looked at, they would have to get the approval of Loretta Lynch. And that is in itself a big process. So it was very clear just through that exchange that the government was not prepared to try this case. And it wasn't like the government was swatted down by some expert legal theory. I mean, let's be very clear here. Ryan Bundy, who has a high school education, he represented himself in this case. This was something we all saw coming, that the judge was not going to just let media interviews in willy-nilly. And it seemed like the government clearly did not prepare for that. And I'm basing that on my own interaction with the government during this time. So, it was just this consistent sense that the government was not prepared.
But everyone was surprised by this verdict. So maybe the government thought that this was going to be a slam dunk and they didn't need to go crazy preparing.
The government really didn't get any curveballs thrown at them. I mean, this is like, I anticipated a lot of the things that happened in this trial, and that's just from watching Law and Order. I don't have a law degree. Like, it was very clear which way the defense was going. It was a pretty clear-cut case, and the government really seemed to be floored by some of the rulings against them.
Well, what was the defense's argument?
Well, the defense made a whole host of arguments. So, for example, in this particular interview that they wanted, that I conducted with Ryan Bundy, that they wanted to get in, they said, well, this guy, we don't know if he manipulated the tape. We don't know if he's trustworthy. I, of course, think I am. But it's a very good argument to make in front of a judge that the person who actually recorded it needs to verify that this is an accurate representation of the person's words. I mean, this is really standard stuff. And the government had no response to that. Early on, there were rulings against the government about Facebook messages and other posts that these occupiers put on the internet. These occupiers broke every single rule that you have for criminals, one of them being that you don't record yourself breaking a law. Not only did they do that, they had press conferences saying that they broke the law. So it seemed like the government really thought all this stuff was just going to get in, no problem. And the defense did a really good job of making sure a lot of that evidence got that would link them together in a conspiracy was excluded from this case.
Well, meanwhile, there's another trial that's going to take place, and this is over the situation in Nevada for that standoff back in 2014. So the Bundy brothers are still in jail awaiting that trial. And do you think that this verdict will affect that case?
I do think it will. I think it will make the government uneasy because I think that the Bundys actually had a harder row in Oregon for a couple of reasons. One, they're not from Oregon, and they were really widely looked at coming from out of state and causing a bunch of problems in Oregon. Two, we need to remember that what happened in Bunkerville, Nevada, is the federal government came to property that was either managed or owned by Cliven Bundy, the father of Ryan and Ammon Bundy. In this case, the one that just got where they were just found not guilty, they actually went to property that was not their own to start this occupation. So already the facts of the case are going to make it, I think, in many ways, much more difficult for the government to prove that these guys broke the law. I also think it should not be understated how much the allure of this kind of idea of the cowboy going against the government, how strong that is. And I think there was an element of that as well. These are guys who wanted to wear cowboy hats and ranching shirts when they went into court. These are people who every day they spoke, they spoke as though they were just folks living off the land. And I think that plays into perception of them. It's all of a sudden much easier to not look at them as potential criminals, but more as kind of this romantic idea of people trying to stand up for the government in much the way that the Old West has done for years and years and years.
John Sepulvedo, he's a reporter and now host of the California Report, which airs every day, every weekday on KCRW during Morning Edition. John, thank you so much. And what's your reaction to the verdict to acquit the Bundys and the others for that standoff in Oregon? You can weigh in on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, hanging out with a militia whose members take up arms to defend the border. We'll find out what happens when a journalist goes undercover for 10 days with a group of guys who want to stop Mexicans from coming to the United States. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country, put your old ride to good use, and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
The This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, there are militia groups all over the West. Journalist Shane Bauer recently went undercover with one of them. It's called 3% United Patriots. He picked up a rifle, he pulled on some camo gear and combat boots, and headed into southern Arizona to look for drug traffickers and illegal immigrants. Shane Bauer wrote a lengthy account of his time with 3% United Patriots for Mother Jones Magazine, where he's a senior reporter, and I spoke with him earlier. Well, how did you get accepted by this group? How did you become a member, and describe that process?
I was actually involved with some other militias before this group that I wrote about. When I started this investigation, I found some militias in California where I live and found them online and just asked if I could join and just kind of showed up. And I'd been training for a few months, just kind of getting familiar with that world. I had started a Facebook account using my real name that I, you know, used just to follow militia groups. I friended a lot of people that liked these militia pages. One day I saw an announcement for a border operation by the 3% United Patriots, which was a group that I had been interested in because it's kind of in a way, a new phase of the far right patriot movement and militia movement, because it's essentially a national militia. It has branches in many states, and it kind of deploys people from around the country to places like the border. When I saw this posting, it was a private Facebook group, and I just requested access to the group. I was granted access, and somebody had a post in there asking who was coming. I said I was coming, and they gave the coordinates, and I just showed up. There was nothing more to it.
And you weren't vetted or anything? I mean, you could have been anyone. You could have been an undercover officer.
Right, or an undercover journalist. And I wasn't vetted at all. You know, this Facebook page, I would kind of keep it active by just reposting blogs claiming that Obama was declaring martial law or that ISIS was coming across the border, and I would just kind of repost these things. So I think, you know, when people looked at my page, it gave the impression that I, you know, was of that world. But I never spoke to anyone on the phone or even had any kind of email interaction. I just showed up.
All right. And so you go along with them on this mission in southern Arizona.
Right.
And is this a weekend long jaunt? How long is it?
This was a 10-day operation.
Oh, a 10-day operation. Okay.
They do these at least a couple times a year, having the national border operations, but their Arizona branch does them regularly. They essentially set up a base, like a small military base, way out in the desert, patrolled by guys carrying AR-15s, you know, semi-automatic rifles, and people basically live there. And from that base, they go out on day and nighttime operations looking for people crossing the border.
And what are they going to do when they find them?
This was never fully explained to me what we were supposed to do, but what I gathered was that we were to radio into the base, who would then call the Border Patrol. But when I went out on these operations, a lot of these guys who are military veterans, they would be really amped up. And, you know, we're going out in these commando style missions with night vision and everything. And they're talking about hunting Mexicans. It wasn't hard to imagine, you know, a scenario where somebody jumps out from behind a bush and runs and somebody gets shot.
So you mentioned that they would call the Border Patrol agents. You had a camera on you, like a body camera. So you recorded some of these interactions. Mm-hmm. And here's a clip of tape from one of your interactions. This is from a Border Patrol agent.
It impresses me that you guys come out to do my job for me for no pay at all.
So they have this kind of cozy relationship with the Border Patrol?
Yeah, they asked us to wear body cameras because they thought that it would be useful to have video in case anyone made false claims against the militia.
So the militia wanted you to wear them.
They did, yeah. So I was wearing it openly and I was just filming all the time. And that piece of video that you were just playing is taken when we were out on a nighttime operation and the Border Patrol showed up not knowing who we were. They saw us using their infrared technology, and there was a brief standoff actually between the militia and the Border Patrol. And once, you know, each side realized who the other was, they put their guns down. And I came up on this scene right after that happened. And one of the agents said that he was an intelligence agent from the Border Patrol, and he started to tell us, you know, where we should be setting up to find people crossing the border. He took us on a drive to show us the right locations. He gave his contact information to the leadership and told him that he would give them unauthorized intelligence briefs.
What does the head of the Border Patrol say about this? This doesn't seem to be, well, it doesn't seem like it should be or it would be authorized to do that.
Well, the Border Patrol would not speak to me. I put all of, you know, the things that I saw, I sent to them in detail, and they just sent me a short comment by email essentially saying that they don't support any groups taking the law into their own hands. It's very likely that the leadership of the Border Patrol is not even aware of this. You know, it's not clear how high up it goes.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with reporter Shane Bauer at Mother Jones about his latest article, Undercover with a Border Militia. So the militia's activities are legal?
That's an open question. It's certainly hard to imagine a scenario like this being allowed if these guys were Muslim or African Americans, but these guys who are mostly white claim that they are extensions of the militia from the time of the Revolutionary War. And there are old kind of arcane laws on the books still that allow for an unorganized militia, which essentially was actually created as a loophole because people used to be required to do mandatory militia service. And states started to get out of that by saying that, yeah, everyone still does militia service, but if you're not actually actively serving, you're considered part of the unorganized militia. So these guys say that they are the unorganized militia. The law does not actually allow for private militias to train. It is only saying that the state can call up the citizenry if it needs to. There are also laws in many states prohibiting paramilitary training and militia training. A lot of these laws require it to be shown that they're causing social unrest, and that is a very difficult thing to prove.
Why are they called the 3% United Patriots?
This group is part of a much larger movement on the far right that started after the election of Obama called the 3%er movement. And the 3%er movement, foundational belief of that movement is that it took 3% of the American population to overthrow the British during the Revolutionary War. And if 3% of the population now get organized, then they can, what they call, you know, restore the Constitution, whatever that means.
And in terms of their political beliefs and their ideology, are they aligned with the white power movement or any of these racist groups that have seen a big increase since President Obama was elected?
They would never call themselves white supremacists. Most of them would deny that they are racist. Often these militias will have one or two members that are not white. At the same time, you know, the movement is mostly made up of working class white men, tend to see themselves as victims of society. And it seems that a lot of them are threatened in a way by changes happening in society where women and people of color are demanding kind of a bigger piece of the pie, in a sense.
You wrote in your piece that it's as if many of the militia leaders know that they're dealing with a pool of volatile white men, some of whom are at risk of doing bad things, of exploding. And for mm-hmm. them, the militia is sort of a safety valve. It gives them a sense of purpose. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they're kind of walking a line in a sense. When I met with the leaders of some militias in California when I was starting to join them, they first set up these kind of informal meetings they call meet and greets where they have a face-to-face interaction with the people that are interested in joining. And a big reason for that is that they're trying to feel out whether the people that want to join them are going to be loose cannons that are going to do something crazy. The guys that are drawn to these militia movements, many of them are pretty alienated. A lot of them have severe PTSD. So there is a way that these kind of alienated guys are, I think, finding meaning in this. At the same time, the militias can validate some of their kind of fantasies of victimization and insurrection. And We have seen a number of militias in the past 5 or 10 years be caught by federal authorities planning terrorist attacks in the United States against government buildings and against private citizens.
Okay, so you spent 10 days out there on the border. Did anything happen? Did they catch anyone?
They did not find anybody actually crossing, but I know that they have in other operations. There was a time that I was out on an operation with two other guys, and we came across a food and water drop, basically jugs of water in the desert and backpacks with anchovies and candy bars in them. And they spilled the water out, destroyed the food. They believed that those were intended for drug cartels. I mean, everything they're doing, they see as fighting drug cartels.
There's one funny anecdote in your piece where they come across a group of people. They start speaking Spanish to them. They speak Spanish back and they say they're Americans. And it turns out that they're scientists studying bats in a cave.
Right. That happened a couple of years ago in the same area. And those guys, you know, from what I read, were really freaked out. Suddenly there's these armed guys in camouflage in the dark, shining their lights at them and telling them to sit down and stay where they are. And turned out they were just scientists looking in a bat cave counting bats.
I mean, it's easy to see the absurdity in all this, but they take this very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there were times when I was out there where, you know, I'm walking around a desert with a guy carrying a sword. It's like they're kind of enacting an elaborate fantasy, but at the same time, they're carrying semi-automatic rifles and looking for actual human beings, you know. It's kind of a mixture of absurdity and something potentially really serious and dangerous. The Colorado branch of the 3% United Patriots has a special forces unit within it. They go through a special training that involves 36 hours of sleep deprivation. They blindfold them and hang them upside down on tilt tables. They tase them. One guy told me that when he was conducting this training, one recruit wouldn't talk, and he brought a female member of the militia in front of this guy and said, if you don't talk, I'm going to tase her. And he wouldn't talk, and he tased and then cattle prodded this woman.
Oh, my God. So the Border Patrol doesn't seem to be that concerned about these guys. What about the Justice Department in general? Are they worried?
I don't know. I've submitted Freedom of Information Act requests about this group, and nobody's gotten back to me yet.
Shane Bauer, he's a senior reporter at Mother Jones, where you can read his in-depth article, Undercover with a Border Militia. He spent some time undercover with the 3% United Patriots and writes all about it. You should check out his story at motherjones.com. Shane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's movie time. Tom Hanks and Leonardo DiCaprio go on a magical mystery tour of the world separately. And there's a new documentary about the band Oasis.
If Oscar Wilde had been functionally illiterate, he would have sounded like Noel Gallagher. You know, which I mean in the best possible way.
Movie reviews next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, which means it is time to talk movies. Katie Walsh is a film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome.
Hi.
And Andrew Barker, senior film writer for Variety. Welcome to you.
Great to be here.
And we're going to start with Inferno. This is based on one of those Dan Brown books in the Da Vinci Code series starring Tom Hanks. Here's a clip from the trailer.
Dante's Inferno isn't fiction. It's a prophecy. Someone created a plague.
Our population is spiraling out of control. Inferno is the cure.
They're going to wipe out half the world's population unless we find this virus. They left a trail.
Human lives are at stake.
If this plague is real,
then we only have 48 hours to stop an extinction-level event.
Okay, Katie, you saw this one, and this is Tom Hanks playing every fantasy that every middle-aged dad bod has.
Well, so I'm not a huge Angels and Demons or Da Vinci Code person. I'm not up on the Dan Brown canon, but you know, you can enjoy this or you can watch this movie without having to know the backstory. But he plays, I think of him as sort of a less spry Indiana Jones. He's a professor of religious iconography and symbology at Harvard, which is not a real field. That's not a real academic discipline.
Wait, what? This isn't like a documentary?
But he sort of like riddles his way through art history to stop some cataclysmic event. In this case, it's a plague that is going to be unleashed by this eccentric billionaire bioengineer played by Ben Foster, who has a lot of opinions about overpopulation and thinks that there's some thinning of the herd that needs to happen. So Dr. Robert Langdon, which is Tom Hanks' character, has to figure out where this plague is located and then stop it from being deployed.
So he's using his brain, not his brawn.
Yes, definitely not his brawn. And he wakes up with a head trauma in Italy. So it's a little bit like Tom Hanks in The Hangover as he tries to figure out what he's been doing for the past 48 hours, how he got to Italy. And the way Ron Howard, who's the director, shoots it, there's a lot of fast cuts, and he's kind of recreating the head trauma that he's having, these oral and visual hallucinations. And I have to admit that I felt like I was experiencing head trauma while watching this film.
And not in a good way?
No. Like halfway through, I was like, I have to look away.
It sounds kind of fun as an escapist experience.
Yeah, you know, I feel like there are going to be people who enjoy it, and there are some, you know, you're running around Italy and Istanbul, and there's a great global cast of superstars from all over the world, but it's not as fun as some other escapist fare that you could have.
Well, what about Tom Hanks, though? We know now from Saturday Night Live that he's really funny.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew before, but we forgot.
Yeah, I think he might have forgotten that, too. And so, yeah,
I say, can we bring him back as a comedian?
Yeah, you know, I would love a future film featuring David S. Pumpkins.
I mean, I'm shocked they haven't rebooted Bosom Buddies at this point.
I know, yeah.
It's sitting right there.
Definitely deserves a reboot. All right, next up, let's talk about a documentary about the hottest band of 1995, Oasis. It's called Supersonic.
No one had ever come along that was even remotely like us.
Their debut album is already the classic of our time.
Then it just blew up.
The most popular rock and roll band in Britain today.
Oasis were involved in a drunken brawl.
Immediately condemned by politicians.
The day that it steps over into the tabloids, then you've gone to the dark side.
Trouble seemed to find us.
It all happened too quick.
Oasis, the troubled Gallagher brothers, and this was the hottest band in the 90s for a while.
For a couple years, yes.
Right? And this movie is about that short period?
It's exclusively about that short period. And actually what's the most interesting about it is that the documentary begins and ends in 1996 when Oasis played this giant concert at Nebworth, actually a series of concerts, and it was something insane like 4% of the British population applied for tickets. So that was like the height of their fame.
Huh.
And it literally makes no mention of the fact that the band continued for 10 years afterward with increasingly diminishing results, which is kind of an interesting choice. But it actually kind of works in the same way that a scripted biopic will be more kind of engaging if, rather than focusing on every single highlight from a person's life, it focuses on a period where things were happening very intensely.
And do we see a lot of the conflict between the two brothers?
Yeah, I mean, you really can't get away from that.
Because that is their story.
That is their story, and they're pretty open about it. And, I mean, I think what makes it so engaging is that they are so incredibly open about their hostility toward each other and their own shortcomings. I mean, you know, Noel Gallagher is a very good songwriter, but he's a brilliant raconteur and interview subject. I mean, if if Oscar Wilde had been functionally illiterate, he would have sounded like Noel Gallagher, you know, which I mean in the best possible way, because he's this out of control, raging narcissist who's also very self-aware about his own ridiculousness. Huh. So having him, because all the band members are sort of interviewed off camera while we see a collage of footage from the time. So having him kind of guide us through his own ridiculous life is really shockingly entertaining.
So, Katie, you also saw this one.
I did.
And what did you think?
I loved it. I think the style is really interesting. It's directed by Matt Whitecross, who's done a bunch of rock docs and rock biopics, but it's produced by Asif Kapadia, who did Amy, which won the Oscar last year about Amy Winehouse. And so it's the same approach of off-screen interviews with archival footage. And I think the editing in this film is really interesting because they take these little scraps of home videos and newspaper clippings and photos and sort of craft these scenes that really make you feel like you're there as they're reminiscing about being at the whiskey or getting deported from Holland for a drunken brawl on a ferry. It really achieves this like cinematic, sonic blend of both image and music.
Okay, let's move on to another documentary. It's called Before the Flood, and Leo DiCaprio travels all over the world to show the effects of climate change. Here's a clip.
We've known about this for decades, for over half a century. Try to have a conversation with anyone about climate change, people just tune out.
Climate change.
Climate change.
Climate change.
And the problem seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. The truth is, the more I've learned about this issue and everything that contributes to the problem, the more I realize how much I don't know.
All right, Andrew, you saw this one.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
Do we learn anything new watching this documentary?
I mean, I think if you have been following this subject intensely, you're probably not going to learn anything new. But it is presented pretty up-to-the-minute discussions of what's happening with the world climate in a very engaging way, not least because it's always Leonardo DiCaprio going to these places and talking to these people.
I'll note he's wearing a man bun in the trailer.
Well, this was while he was filming The Revenant mostly, so okay. A lot of times he has the giant bushy mountain man beard as well.
All right. Yeah. So he looks like he's ready to take on this challenge.
Right.
And, you know, you can make fun of actors for taking on these causes, but in fact, maybe a lot of people wouldn't care if an actor wasn't front and center, if it wasn't him or an Angelina Jolie or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think this film actually does some interesting things with the idea of celebrity activism in the sense that, I mean, it actually starts off with sort of a collage of Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity making fun of Leonardo DiCaprio for being this Hollywood activist. But because he's a Hollywood activist, you know, he's able to say, get Barack Obama to talk to him and go meet Pope Francis and get John Kerry to talk to him and just get us to pay attention to him. And he's pretty much, he kind of makes for a good guide because he's not actually a scientist. You know, he knows less than a climate scientist would, less even than Al Gore does. So he sort of is a good audience surrogate because he's not talking at a higher level. He's sort of like, okay, so what does this mean? And how can you make this tangible to me? That said, there is a little bit of the actorly narcissism that goes on. I mean, for example, we actually see him go to the set of The Revenant, and then it ends with him making a speech to the UN General Assembly. It feels sort of like a retread of his entire Oscar campaign a little bit.
Mm.
So that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. But on the whole, it's actually very well put together. Fisher Stevens directed it. And Fisher Stevens came out and said that they were specifically releasing it as close as possible to the U.S. election to try to influence the way people vote. And then, of course, this election has been such a horror show soap opera that no one has even mentioned this cause in the course of the election.
Yeah, I don't know if global warming has really been discussed.
Other things to talk about.
Yeah. So, but that brings up the question of who's going to watch this movie anyway. It's sort of, is he preaching to the converted?
Probably, but if the unconverted are going to tune in for any reason, I guess watching Leonardo DiCaprio take a magical mystery tour around climate hotspots is about as good as you can do.
Okay. So it seems like there are a lot of people roaming the world this week.
Yeah.
Touring magical hotspots. Okay. Andrew Barker, senior film writer for Variety, Katie Walsh, film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to tour magical hotspots, how about doing it in a flying car? Yes, Uber has a plan to bring flying cars to you soon. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Two words, flying cars. Here's one more. Uber. Yes, the company that has revolutionized the taxi world and has already introduced self-driving cars in Pittsburgh is now talking about introducing a fleet of flying cars, not in the next century, but within a decade. Alex Davies is senior associate editor at Wired Magazine. He's looked into this. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, is this just a crazy pipe dream?
Amazingly, it's not. And I think that was my reaction when I first started talking to Uber about this idea. But then when I started digging into it and talking to aviation and regulatory experts, it seems that the technology that Uber hopes to tap into really is almost ready, and that within the next 5 years, to get the actual aircraft needed for this is not such a crazy idea.
Where would they get this aircraft? Are they going to build them?
So they have no intention of actually building airplanes themselves. They're hoping to tap into any one of a number of companies that are working on these. They'll be fully electric aircraft, and they'll be what are called VTOL planes, which means vertical takeoff and landing. It's kind of a combination of a helicopter and an airplane, like the Harrier jet, but much more efficient, much safer, much easier to fly. And there are various startups around the world working on these, and Boeing and Airbus seem to have plans for aircraft along these lines as well. So Uber would be using one of those manufacturers' products.
Okay, so if all of these companies, these defense companies or what have you, DARPA even, are involved, why should we trust Uber to do this?
So Uber's play here is they're saying that they don't even want to be the only ones making it. They want to be a catalyst for making this market happen. They say that Uber's in the best position to take those aircraft, which will probably be expensive and hard to access for most people, and do what they've already done with cars, which is create a market by matching demand with pilots and coming up with routes, which I think it's fair to say they've done effectively for people trying to get around cities in cars. And that's what they want to do here, too.
And what about the airspace? There's already a lot in it, at least around here. How would that actually work?
That is the real problematic part here. I was kind of amazed that the technology is as ready as it is. But when you start talking to people who know about what it's like to get the FAA to certify something and get a new aircraft actually into American airspace, things get way more complicated. And 5 years is very generous. Even 10 might not happen. Just because these are entirely new kinds of aircraft, we don't know what kinds of testing they'd have to go through. And then to actually get them into airspace, you need to rely on new systems that NASA and the FAA have been working on for years and that they're hoping to use to control drone technology. But it's not ready yet, and it's unclear when it will actually be ready for primetime use. So the timeline on that is much harder to pin down.
Okay, well, with Uber, it's easy to find a fleet of drivers, right? Most adults know how to drive. But how many adults know how to fly an aircraft? So where would you find these pilots?
Not nearly enough adults know how to fly planes to actually fill these gaps. What Uber hopes is that because the software in these aircraft would be much more advanced, you'd be able to change pilot certification and make it a much lower bar to entry. That gets you back into the problem of dealing with the FAA, which has never really certified software in the sense which would be semi-autonomous, where you would get into the aircraft, you'd say, I want to go from here to here. So you enter your destination. It does the bulk of the work for you, and the human would be there to sort of supervise. And ideally, within a few years or maybe a decade or two after that, you could go to autonomous planes. But the idea of the FAA saying, sure, like, go ahead, like, we'll have pilots in there, but they won't be trained as much as normal pilots, that's a hairier thing to agree to.
Yeah, that sounds a little frightening. I'm not sure I want the bar lowered. the BARTA entry.
Exactly,
lower.
Especially if you're flying through cities, landing on rooftops. It's a trickier spot.
Right. You think you'd want the bar even higher. But anyway, so this idea of flying cars, it's been around for a long time. I remember the Jetsons. And even before that, didn't Henry Ford have this plan back in the 40s?
Yeah, Henry Ford, I think he first tried to work on something like back in the 20s. And then in 1940, he was quoted by a reporter saying, "Don't worry, like, this tech is right around the corner. It's right here." Obviously, he wasn't thinking about like electric powered vertical takeoff and landing, the stuff we're talking about now. But the idea has been around basically as long as we've had cars and airplanes, which is more than a century now. It's been on who knows how many popular science covers. And it's really exciting. But what seems different here is that this is Uber saying, "Hey, like, we really think this is something. This is not just a press release saying we want to do this." It's like a 100-page technical paper that really lays out the challenges in a way where you read it and you say, "Okay, like, there's a lot to finish here. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, but it's theoretically, it's really feasible."
Wow. Well, what's more feasible, this or the Hyperloop?
So I think that one's tricky. Hyperloop, I think, is based on really plausible technology, but where Uber will rush to say they have the advantage here is that Hyperloop, like high-speed rail, like so many other things, requires a lot of heavy infrastructure. This doesn't. This, you know, there are thousands of helicopter landing pads around the U.S. I think there are hundreds in downtown Los Angeles because for decades, building code said that if you built over X number of stories, you have to have a helicopter landing pad on top. And Uber says, "Well, we just need to, you know, make sure those things have an outlet so we can charge up, and then we can land there. So you don't need to be building hundreds of miles of rails and tubes and vacuum pumps to make this happen. You just need the aircraft and the legal authority to do it."
Wow. So it sounds like you're putting your money on Uber over the Hyperloop.
I don't know if I'd put money, or at least not a lot of money, on either.
Uh-huh.
But I think that this is something that could certainly happen if the FAA is willing to loosen up its rulemaking procedures a little bit and push it forward.
Alex Davies, Senior Associate Editor at Wired Magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jolie Myers is here now to give us the listener feedback.
I am here.
Are you stunned at that idea of flying cars?
You know what? Traffic is already bad enough here. If we started to stack it, I don't know. Like, the idea of having cars flying over other cars flying over other cars.
What if it's just gently hovering over the cars, like by 10 feet or something?
That's
just
even creepier. It's
hovering.
Like breathing on your neck. Like, no, I don't know. I'm not a first adopter, though, so we'll see how it goes. Well, we talked about the situation in the Standing Rock situation.
In North Dakota.
Thank
with
you.
The Sioux, and the pipeline.
Yes,
yep.
Exactly. And Carl Segerstrom says it's a sad day for America. White people armed to the teeth at the Oregon standoff, all found not guilty, while Standing Rock protesters are removed by force. What is the deal with that? And Rhonda Holly says that if someone tried to run an oil pipeline through Arlington National Cemetery, everyone would freak out. Well, this is Arlington to the Standing Rock. So
okay.
If you want to share your thoughts, Twitter, KCRW Press Play.
Hey, have a great Halloween weekend.
You too.
Thank you.
I'm going to dress as a Jolie.
Okay, good. That's not that scary. All right. Maybe a little. All right. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.